You're listening to High Vibe Mindset, where entrepreneurs Aaron Smith, a sports physician assistant, and Melissa Smith, an intuitive eating dietitian and mindset coach, dive into all the juicy details of business, relationships, health, science, and spirituality. Now let's dive in. This episode is sponsored by my free 3-day intuitive eating mindset challenge. This free challenge is for anyone who wants to kickstart their intuitive eating journey and learn how to get aligned to what works for you. This challenge is designed to help you learn what type of eater you are and what might be keeping you stuck in a less than ideal relationship with food or with your body. You can learn how to stop the harmful yo-yo dieting cycle and adopt self-compassionate mindfulness while ditching the harmful all-or-nothing mindset. And you'll learn how to flex those intuitive eating muscles we are all born with that have been buried by diet culture. This challenge is great for those experiencing food obsession and overwhelm. So if you're always thinking about your next meal or a cheat meal, if you're just so over calorie tracking and macro counting and everything like that of having to weigh your food and portion out your food, if you find that you're always starting and stopping diets and just nothing seems to work for you, and if you find that you're starting to get anxiety just thinking about food, then it's time to ditch diets and get in touch with your body through intuitive eating. Take action today by joining the challenge and you'll get the guidance you've been looking for straight to your inbox. In just 3 days, you can massively shift your relationship with food and body, discover and eliminate what has been keeping you stuck, and make powerful, lasting transformation toward healthful living. So to sign up for the challenge, simply go to www.intuitiveeatingmindset.org/3-day-challenge.
Christy Molnar is a registered dietitian practicing in Phoenix, Arizona. Over the past 10 years, she has served as a community dietitian in the country's third largest health jurisdiction at the Department of Public Health. And in this role, she has worked alongside members of underserved, low-income communities with the collective goal to create equitable opportunities for all people to live healthier lives. It was by personally understanding and witnessing the role of trauma and toxic stress on food behaviors, community health, and health outcomes that Christy takes a trauma-informed approach now to all of her work. She strives to educate and train others on how to take a trauma-informed approach to nutrition and healthcare. Her passion to empower and improve the lives of trauma survivors has led her to become a certified clinical trauma specialist individual through the Trauma Institute International. And I'm so excited for this episode. If we have any entrepreneurs listening in the wellness space or who are healthcare service providers, this is going to be such an important episode because it is really crucial to become trauma-informed. And that's exactly what we're going to dive into in this episode. We're going to dive really deep and talk all about what it means to be trauma-informed so that you can walk away and improve your healthcare, improve your service with your clients and know where they're coming from. Christy, you're dedicating yourself to bringing awareness to the role trauma can play in nutrition and food choices and why the trauma-informed approach to nutrition is important for everyone who has experienced past or present trauma. So we would love if you can share with us what it means to be trauma-informed and what trauma-informed nutrition looks like.
Sure. Yes, I'd be happy to answer that. So to be trauma-informed and just in general is essential, first off, for serving individuals who have experienced trauma or toxic stress. There's a framework put out by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration out of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. A framework to providing trauma-informed care requires understanding, recognizing, training, integrating, and resisting. Understanding just means the, understanding the prevalence and how perverse the trauma is and how prevalent adversity is, throughout our country, throughout our world. And then ultimately understanding the impacts on the health and behavior, and then recognizing the effects of trauma. So being trauma informed, also, you need to be able to recognize the effects and the biological behaviors associated with this toxic stress and ultimately what it does to our health and behaviors. And then, taking it a step up, for example, in an organization to become trauma-informed, it then requires training in leadership, training of the leadership and the providers and the staff, just to understand what are some best practices to working with patients or clients, through that trauma lens. And then ultimately integrating this knowledge into, policies and procedures, again, at an organizational to a higher policy level. And then, of course, resisting re-traumatization by approaching patients or clients who have experienced trauma with non-judgmental support, but also just understanding little things that, may be considered triggers in resisting that re-traumatization. But further, it just looks into, building safety, building trust, making it patient-centered, having the patient as part of every decision when it comes to treatment and care. So having that collaboration between provider and patient. And then, of course, always being sensitive to, racial, ethnic, cultural backgrounds and gender identity. Specifically, when it comes to trauma-informed nutrition, it's an approach to nutrition and health behaviors that recognizes that relationship between adversity and nutrition health. And then, of course, it recognizes the signs and symptoms of toxic stress, which many can be food-related, which I'll talk about later. And then just understanding that these symptoms are due to the disruption of biology in our body and in our brains, and that can exacerbate an unhealthy relationship with food. And then just understanding the relationship also between the individual, family, and communities is a critical piece to trauma-informed nutrition, and understanding one's position interpersonally or interpersonally, and then, our relationship with communities. I'll talk more about that a little bit later, but just taking a more holistic and salutogenic perspective to treatment and care.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much for explaining that. I definitely know that trauma's very prevalent, but it's something that we're just not educated on. And I think it is so important to be trauma informed for everyone, and especially as a healthcare provider, to have that education and that understanding to be able to develop good rapport with your patient, to understand what might be a trigger and be able to understand better ways to be able to work with them. And can you give us a recap and kind of tell us what are some sources that might cause trauma in individuals?
Yeah, absolutely. And before I get into potential sources, let me just go ahead and define trauma and also further define what toxic stress is. The two words can be used interchangeably, but let's just get the definitions. So when it comes to trauma, and again, I'm going to quote the SAMHSA's definition, that's the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration. They define trauma as an emotional response to an event, a series of events or circumstances that are interrupted as, or I'm sorry, that are interpreted as harmful or life-threatening and have the potential to result in lasting negative effects on one's physical, mental, social, emotional, or spiritual well-being. It can be summed up using the three E's. So an event that is emotionally painful or distressing that is experienced as abnormally intense or stressful. And then the third E is the effects. It affects the physical and mental health, which can have adverse and lasting effects. And we also need to keep in mind trauma, it isn't necessarily just one big bad event, not one singular event. It can be repeated and chronic. Individuals who experience events don't always perceive them or react the same way, though. And the biggest determining factor of that is the presence of support and having nurturing relationships to help buffer that stress response. And that nurturing relationship can come within the family through peer support and or just having that support, within the community. But then toxic stress, we'll look at it is more kind of the biological definition. And stress, first, I should mention, isn't always bad. There's positive stress and there's tolerable stress. Positive stress, is just that surge of energy, and, you know, sometimes leads to increased focus to do better at a task or, like, you know, a big game or a presentation. Tolerable stress is a stress response that activates the body's stress response to a greater degree and for a longer amount of time. And if that activation is time limited and buffered by relationships that then bring, you know, supporting relationships that can help bring tolerable stress to be just that, tolerable, and could ultimately lead, you know, to have positive effects. But toxic stress is the one that, you know, we relate mostly to traumatized individuals or individuals with histories of trauma. And toxic stress is the result of repeated, like, chronic exposure to traumatic events that activate the body's stress response system. And I'll talk about that stress response system a little bit later. But ultimately, it's the activation of the body's stress response. And again, in the absence of a nurturing adult or caregiver. Yeah, it's the absence of these relationships that, you know, are the important factor for resilience, both in children and adults. But without it, and the chronic, you know, repeat exposure and the activation of the stress response can ultimately disrupt the brain architecture, our organs, such as the, you know, ones within the endocrine, cardiovascular, digestive areas, metabolic systems. And it increases the risk for stress-related disease and, you know, cognitive impairment. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you know, different physical and mental health disorders. So then if we want to discuss, like, what are the sources of toxic stress, they can be labeled, they can be a multitude of different types of environments, whether that's chaotic, aggressive, punitive, inconsistent or unstable. And chaotic environments, you know, are within the household or the neighborhood or even a school. But relating it to food, particularly, a chaotic environment can be looked at as like a loss of food traditions, you know, due to migration or being, you know, bullied because of being overweight or underweight. So that kind of creates that chaos in the environment, and particularly for an individual being affected by it. Mm-hmm. There's aggressive environments that, you know, when rules come before that caring, supportive relationship. So I always think when it comes to food, it's like, you know, having strict food rules and restricting food from kids or ourselves, forcing ourselves to clean the plate or our children to clean the plate. And even just using food as a form of reward or punishment can sometimes be looked at, you know, as a rule before that supportive relationship. The idea of punitive is just characterized by harsh and physical verbal punishments, you know, within households, even schools, and justice involved individuals really, you know, experience that punitive environment, whether being, you know, incarcerated or just going through that judicial system alone in that environment. But food related, you know, it's again, forcing a child to diet, criticizing a child's weight and using food as a form of punishment. And then, of course, inconsistent and unstable environments, you know, not just household dysfunction within communities, and then just a lack of ability to trust people and situations. So when it comes to food, that's, you know, sometimes not having access to food or being food insecure, not knowing when your next meal is. Or, you know, there's times where parents forget to feed their child because a parent is too caught up in their own behavioral health concerns or mental health concerns. And so that can always happen as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that explanation. And it just makes me think about how important this is to be aware of and to integrate when, you know, for doctors, for dietitians, nurses, anyone working with patients. And I think a lot of times we just focus on the teaching or what they should be doing, but we're not getting the full picture to understand where they're at and understand what actually is the first step that's going to help them. So we really need to take an even more individualized approach and be able to recognize this and ask the right questions and see, like, do you have consistent meal times? Do you have consistent access to food? And understand more where they're coming from so that we can take that trauma-informed approach and recognize if they have trauma and recognize the signs of stress, if it's not trauma related or maybe just toxic stress, and understanding how that might be affecting them and seeing those signs.
Yeah, absolutely. And also understanding, like, it's not just, you know, individual level type stuff, but it expands. And I'll just go into a little bit more about like the, you know, different types, kind of conceptualize toxic stress in the form of being historical. It can be systemic and it can be come, you know, within from a community. And then of course there's the ACEs, which is the individual, kind of more individual traumatic experiences through adverse childhood experiences. And I can go a little bit into what these are.
Yeah, we would love that.
Yeah. So historical trauma is a type of intergenerational trauma. So it can actually be passed down from a parent to a child to a grandchild. I mean, it can be a self-perpetuated cycle. It's overall the psychological injury from a community or a group of people that's caused by historical injustices and just systemic abuse. You know, for example, you know, different cultures and racial ethnic groups have experienced this. There's some major oppressive events, such as the Holocaust, would be an example of traumatic or historical trauma. Forced migration can lead to historical slavery and in the violent colonization of indigenous people. Also, families that experience intergenerational poverty. So families experiencing poverty, that stress and that burden from on the mother and the parent, you know, can affect how they respond to their child and whether or not they're able to provide that supportive relationship to the child. But ultimately, it can affect too. The stress can affect whether a mother can conceive. And if, you know, conception occurs, that stress really can have an impact on the developing child. So the developing child is already at a setback before he or she or they are already born. And then, you know, it's just they grow up, children grow up, and then have children. And unless they can break that cycle, that's where it comes intergenerational. And then, like I said, there's the systemic type of concept of toxic stress. And that's just the idea of putting practices and procedures implemented by, you know, certain institutions or their leaders that directly or indirectly cause psychological, emotional, economic, spiritual, physical harm to individuals or a specific group of people.
Are you looking to elevate your client experience to the next level? Whether you're in the wellness, photography, or mental health worlds, imagine the impact of offering your client a truly unique and memorable gift that supports them on a personal level. Introducing the Custom Affirmation Card Decks by Soleia. Our custom affirmation decks are designed to empower and inspire your clients, leaving a lasting impression that strengthens your professional relationship. So picture this. Your own branded affirmation cards, beautifully crafted with imagery that reflects your brand's essence. These card decks serve as more than just a gift. They become a daily reminder of your commitment to your client's well-being and success. Whether you're a life coach, yoga instructor, therapist, or photographer, your custom card deck supports your client's personal growth, even when they're not in a session with you. So why settle for generic gifts like candles or pens when you can create something truly transformational and beautiful? With Soleia's custom affirmation cards, you can tailor every aspect to align with your brand identity and the values that you stand for. And this process is easy for you. We do all the heavy lifting from design to ordering. Simply choose your affirmations, select the imagery, and add your logo and branding elements. We'll take care of the rest, delivering a high-quality, personalized product. Join the ranks of leading wellness, photography, and mental health professionals who are elevating their client experience with custom affirmation card decks from Soleia. Visit our website today at soleia.co/custom to learn more and start creating your own unforgettable client gifts. That's soleia.co/custom. And I'll spell it out for you, soleia.co/custom. Together, let's inspire positivity and empower transformation, one affirmation at a time.
So you mentioned that these people have to break the cycle. That would be the best thing for them. Do you have any tips or, I guess, common ways that people are able to break that cycle?
Yeah, absolutely. I will be talking about that in a little bit. First, I'd like to just kind of break down maybe the biology of what's going on in our brains and then how we can go about approaching that. But definitely, I'll get into like specifics on what we can do with clients and ourselves to help break that and to answer your question. But I appreciate your eagerness. But also, I just want to get into, because I know this specific question was asked, like community trauma as well. And that's a collective trauma. It's just an aggregate of trauma experienced by a community. And a community can be defined as geographical, cultural, organizational. I mean, for example, like our community, our country right now, specific examples, you know, with all that's going on, COVID and our response to COVID, the political environment, you know, this is all having, you know, or can have that toxic stress response on our body unless we're able to self-regulate. And then that's what I'll be talking about in a little bit. Also, just understanding that, you know, community trauma, there's certain symptoms that have been defined. I mean, symptoms of community level trauma can be like specifically within a neighborhood, a physically like deteriorated or unhealthy or unsafe public spaces. And also a big one, just coming from the field of public health and working in the with nutrition and community nutrition programs, is the lack of availability of healthy products. So yeah, a symptom of community trauma is that disinvestment, not getting healthy products available. And just that leads to then an overall disinvestment in a community, you know, limits employment and just kind of keeps that intergenerational poverty cycle going. And then also just the symptoms of community trauma themselves can be traumatic. So like stuff, you know, experienced in the community becomes traumatic. And then kind of it blurs the distinction between what's the underlying condition and the symptom. So it's just a cycle of how, you know, this community level can feed into the individual. And then the individual feeds into that community trauma through destructive social norms, alcoholism, drug abuse, and just, yeah, you know, damaged social relationships, so on and so forth.
I think it is important to realize, and people can come with several types of trauma. They could have that, maybe that individual level or that collective level or that historical level that they're dealing with. So yeah, we would love to hear your insights on that individual level with the ACEs.
Yeah. And so the ACEs, real quick, it started as a study in the 90s as a weight management program. When they found out, you know, people were getting tremendous results, but then they would drop out. Like, especially the people that were having success would drop out of the treatment or they would gain all the weight back upon completion, which back in the 90s, I know back then they're still dabbling with diets. We know diets don't work, but that's besides the point. The idea is that back in the 90s, that led to the research question of could weight issues be related to what happened earlier in life? And so that's through, you know, Kaiser Permanente healthcare system in California, partnered with the CDC. And they looked into comparing health outcome data with three specific kinds of adversity in a child. So a child is defined from 0 to 18 years of age. And they found the strong relationship between early life experience and later health outcomes. Specifically, the three kinds of adverse individual child adversity that children faced in their home were categorized as abuse, so physical, emotional, or sexual, neglect, so neglect, you know, physically and emotionally, and then looked into specific household dysfunction, such as living with a parent or caregiver with a mental illness, an incarcerated relative, you know, if there was somebody in the family that was suffering from substance abuse, domestic violence was another one, loss of a parent in divorce. Mm-hmm. But since then, they've done so much more research and they've actually expanded this out. So like the screening tool for ACEs, which, you know, you're talking about the idea of recognizing, you know, when mm-hmm. it comes to primary care, that comes to screening. But since then, studies have expanded to understand adversity is more than just those 10 and that they defined in, you know, those original studies. And it's since been expanded to, you know, incorporate neighborhood and community school violence, bullying, war, discrimination, housing problems, food insecurity, not having enough to eat, living with a family member, not only with a mental illness, but also physical illness, and then family separation, for example, due to, you know, foster care, immigration. But the original study, just kind of what I was saying and what has been, you know, repeated over and over, is that the prevalence of ACEs is actually really high. And it was reported that, you know, that original study was 6 in 10 had at least one ACE, and 1 in 8, closer now to what, 1 in 6 reported at least 4 or more ACEs.
Yeah.
And one thing also to keep in mind with that original ACE study, it was conducted among a population that was mostly employed, mostly white, middle class, college educated, that had insurance. So you could have imagined like how much more prevalent that would be, you know, in that original study, if there was more diversity and just less educated, not having access to health insurance, et cetera. But again, in replicated studies, that's where they, you know, expanded the idea and those that they focused on. So yeah, it's just high prevalence among individuals. And so that's, again, recognizing the prevalency is a key step to being trauma-informed and understand that, like, it's among everyone. And again, without that nurturing, supportive relationship to help buffer that stress response, is really determines how we will react to those ACEs or to that adversity and that toxic stress. But yeah, ACEs, you know, is associated with 9 of the leading causes of death. And then it's also been found, like, the more ACEs you have, the greater risk for just over 40 different health outcomes to date. And it's not even just, you know, health, but different behaviors like smoking, food-related behaviors, drug abuse, and even life potential, like when it comes to academic achievement, graduation rates, and just productivity or lost time from work. So in order to cope with the trauma, both individually and collectively, like, how do we do that? And that's where the idea is, first and foremost, we need to learn to regulate our bodies. Once we learn to regulate our bodies, that's where the idea of co-regulation comes in, which I'll talk about. But the idea to regulate our bodies and become more aware of internal signals within our body. So just being neuroceptive to our environments. And that's really our ability to distinguish whether situations or people are safe, dangerous, or life-threatening. Because if you think about it, like, our chronic stress response throughout the day, we're being thrown with all these potential threats, right? But some of us will see that, you know, just to not ignore it, but understand, like, oh, that's not an immediate threat to me right here and right now. Whereas, you know, others who have less ability to recognize, you know, that they are in fact stressing or worrying or, you know, triggered, if you will, that it's actually not harmful. So being able to recognize what is actually dangerous versus just a perceived threat. And then having that neuroceptive ability and that cellular awareness then leads to more like introspective awareness. So the present felt sense. The felt sense of our own physiological process. So being able to feel what's actually going on in our body and being able to feel when our body is shifting into the fight or flight mode. And it's just becoming sensitive to that feedback in our body. So recognizing it and then being sensitive. And then I'll talk about some different ideas on how to then bring the body back into what's called our window of tolerance. But through self-care, once we're able to then master, I shouldn't say master, because it's a forever learning experience. I mean, we'll forever need to be in tune with our bodies. And by no means does it come easy. But once we're able to really just be more introspective and understand and recognizing when we're dysregulated, take the steps to become regulated. And then that's where other self-care can come in, through just stress management techniques, balanced nutrition, sleep, joyful movements, et cetera. So what, you know, is happening within the body? I like to, and I'm stealing this from the Arizona Trauma Institute. That's where I got my training as a certified clinical support trauma specialist. Mm-hmm. So I'm using their analogy of the fiery cocktail. And the fiery cocktail is just a metaphor for all the biochemicals and hormones that are released in response to a perceived or a real threat of danger. Examples include epinephrine, cortisol, you know, I'm sure you've heard of cortisol, adrenaline, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So when we get that perceived or real threat, our body releases these biochemicals, and that shifts us into what's called a sympathetic dominance. And a sympathetic dominance is, you know, what is commonly referred to as a fight, flight, or freeze mode. But this stuff, this fiery cocktail, if you will, it can take up to 4 days to metabolize. And repeated chronic exposure to these hormones is what ultimately impacts the, you know, immune system, the endocrine system, our digestive system, et cetera.
Wow.
But what I talked about or mentioned earlier is that window of tolerance. And so we all have a window of tolerance. And that window of tolerance is when we're in that relaxed state. We're in that relaxed body. We're calm. We're able to manage new stressors and emotions. Not that that doesn't fluctuate up and down, but it keeps us, you know, kind of in this balanced state, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it's in this state that we can access the front of our brain, the prefrontal cortex, specifically the executive functioning part of our brain, that makes us ready to learn and problem solve. Also, you know, just to be introspective and self-reflective. However, it's when that fiery cocktail, we get that shot, if you will. What that can do is then take us into that sympathetic dominance, whether it be the hyperarousal, the fight or flight mode, or into a hypoarousal state where that's the freeze response. But here's a really kind of couple key points to this is how much it takes, you know, for to set somebody off, if you will, to get them out of their window of tolerance really depends on the person and their lived experience, what they've experienced in their life. And of course, whether or not the presence of those supportive relationships were there to help regulate the child, help infant, and then just, you know, later on, you know, through a child and adult life. So for some, it could be just a little bit. It could just set them over for those who've had not as an optimal life history versus somebody who's had optimal life history. It takes a whole lot of that in terms of volume.
It kind of sounds like maybe the more ACEs someone has, it might be harder. Maybe, right? The more trauma, the more life experiences they have, it may or may not, but maybe more often than not correlate with how hard it is for them to overcome that fiery cocktail.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's also to the point, like it takes up to 4 days to fully metabolize these chemicals, right? So if you're getting repeated exposures, you're just going to be in that biological state where you're in a constant sympathetic dominance, fight, flight, freeze mode. So yeah, you know, having that more experiences in the past could ultimately lead to that idea of not being able to stay in that window of tolerance. But what's really also interesting too is the idea of these behaviors that it's not just an association, but the causal result of these biochemicals flooding our body. And I mean, just at face value, like, you know, we recognize increased breathing, heart rate, muscle tension, body aches, increased blood sugar, inability to digest, but also the behaviors that sometimes we write off as being bad behaviors or annoying behaviors. And that's, you know, when the fight or flight mode, that's where anger, aggression, being reactive, being irrational, not being able to focus, being hypervigilant, all that comes in. So if these aren't chosen behaviors, if you will, but if you're in that dominant mode, you're not accessing that front part of your brain. So you're not accessing that part of your brain that is needed for managing stress and emotions. Further, like when you're in that freeze mode, again, shuts down the body, but the behavior is also associated with that, or people wanting to hide, recluse, you know, not wanting to participate, disengage, and just being, you know, sad and emotionally distracted.
And that makes a lot of sense. I think that helps kind of remove the shame and stigma and blame behind things, because it's not a response people want to have. And I'm sure they feel a lot of shame when they're acting in that response. So it's important for us to have this awareness so we can learn, you know, have the awareness that that's happening and the reason why it's happening. And then, okay, now how can we begin to cope or kind of change these reactions, manage, and not go into that fight or flight as much. So we would love to kind of start talking about that.
To kind of bring it together to like the idea of when it comes to the stigma, when we are, when our biology, when we're being disrupted by these biochemicals, you know, we're dysregulated. But then, like I said, we lose access to our hippocampus and our executive functioning. And what's important to remember about that is the executive functioning part of our brain is our thinking brain. These are the, we need access to this so for many nutrition behaviors, right? So like executive functioning controls our ability to like read a recipe. So like sequential, being able to look at things sequentially, planning and prioritizing, memory, impulse control, and just making health a priority. So again, if we're dysregulated, we're not having access to the executive function. And I don't want to necessarily say that our efforts will, you know, be of waste, but people aren't going to choose to do these certain behaviors that we're teaching them if they're in a dysregulated body. Like they're just biologically not able to. So I think that's a really key point.
That's an amazing point. I think that's really important to recognize. And it kind of helps us see, right? Well, why is someone struggling so much to be able to get through creating a recipe? And it's important for us to have compassion and to ask these questions and kind of see where people are coming from than just be like, well, that's ridiculous, right? And to understand, well, what's the reasoning behind and how can we help and how can we lower their stress or how can we help them get the right resources to be able to start to regulate and be able to get those executive functions back online in a better way so that they can do these actions that I'm sure they want to do. Everyone wants to be healthy and be able to do these things, but we have to work with people where they're at.
Yeah. And ultimately, you know, teaching people to relax the body will ultimately improve the symptoms, whether the symptoms, you know, be something of eating, you know, overeating, impulsive eating, distracted eating, emotional eating, or, you know, just certain symptoms, you know, within our body that are presenting. So first and foremost, the key is just to relax the body. And so when it comes to just mindful techniques, this is the idea of, you know, balanced nutrition. So keeping blood sugar regulated, eating foods that are higher in antioxidants, because this is causing a lot of this, the health outcomes are a result of chronic inflammation in the body. So this chronic inflammation, so eating foods that help lower that inflammatory response, and then just healing the gut, and healthy fats are good for the brain. But then of course, like physical activity, quality sleep, having those supportive relationships, accessing mental health care when needed, getting out in nature, and then, you know, practicing mindfulness are all ways to then further manage the stress once we get our bodies regulated.
Is there anything we did not cover that you'd like to share?
I know I've been talking a lot. I'm sorry for going over.
I mean, this could be like a 3-part series. I love it because I actually wasn't expecting. And I like that you went so deep into these questions. And I know we had a lot of questions, but I think it will be great. And you could always come back and we could talk about the other things that you do too. But I think just going over, we went really deep in a subject, which I actually love. So no worries.
Good. Well, I'd be happy to come back too. If there's anything else that I would like to add, this is where just the idea, we need to remember that we are in this present moment, we are doing the best we can. Like we are who we are because of our lived experience and what we're doing right now, we are doing the best we can. And we need to remember that it's also enough. I know, you know, there's stress and just all this idea of being better and doing better, but just recognizing whatever we're doing here and now, whatever's going on in our lives, we're doing our best we can. And it's enough. So that hopefully will help further create that ability to be kind to ourselves, but also to be kind to others, you know, especially knowing just how many of us can be impacted by toxic stress and adversities as a child all the way up until now.
Definitely. And then our last few questions are, if you have any go-to mindset practices, routines, or resources to stay high vibe, and then where listeners can find you and how they can work with you.
Sure. For me personally, getting in the practice, making it a priority to do a 10-minute meditation every morning to start my morning, to get myself into that mode to where then I can help other people. Because we really, it's like I said earlier, starts with us. We got to regulate our bodies first before we can help others to regulate their bodies. So just you know, the practicing that 10 to 20 minute meditation. I love going for walks. Just getting out in nature is huge. And I understand some people don't have the luxury of accessing nature, you know, whether even be a city park or, you know, traveling. That's where I like to bring stuff into the home, like an indoor plant or plants, putting a bird feeder outside of the window, and or just playing like on Spotify or wherever you get your music, like nature sounds. So those are some quick, easy ways of just bringing it to us in the home. But another thing that I've learned has been very effective is body scan, and not necessarily a 10 minute body scan, but just like a quick, like, where am I feeling tense? Like from my head to my toe, going through my body, where, and just releasing that tension. Cause that's really just stress being, you know, stored in our body. Sources though, I highly recommend the Well Nourished book by Andrea Lieberstein. She's a registered dietitian, and it's all about mindful eating. And it gets into the actual mindful eating part, which I didn't even touch on, but like what that means and what that can do for our body. Mm-hmm. UCLA has some free resources for mindfulness. There's a paced breathing app on Android. I'm not sure about iPhone. If you just Google, you know, kind of paced breathing, I always go to a reputable source, like a .edu is one that I like to focus on or get my information.
Awesome.
You know, yeah. And also I'll check out the Harvard University's Center for Developing Child if you want to really dig deep into this rabbit hole of information.
Awesome. We'll put all of that in the show notes, and then we would definitely love to know where to find you and how listeners can work with you, and we'll put that in the show notes too. So where can listeners find you?
So my goal was to have my website up by now, but it's not. So right now I'm just on social media, Instagram at The Trauma Dietitian. That's more the personal account working with individuals. Then I have the professional account, and that's at trauma.informed.wellness. Otherwise, my email, it's Christy, Christi.rdn@gmail.com. And I'm partnering with people, doing training, speaking engagements, also working on a program for individuals following a trauma-informed care framework. So you can email me if you want to join that wait list.
Awesome. Super exciting. Well, thank you so much. And we really appreciate you being on the episode. It was lots of great information.
Very happy to be here. Thank you.
If you loved this episode, subscribe and stay notified for new episodes every Tuesday. Leave us a review with what you liked or what you want more of. And don't forget, stay high vibe.
Do you know these three things are sabotaging your ability to live your high vibe life? First is living in disconnection, which basically means walking around with no awareness of your body, emotions, or values. And second is letting negative self-talk run the show in your brain. That's just going to make you doubt your potential and stop you from going after your dreams. Finally, it's not having any supportive coping practices or self-care that doesn't take hours or cost tons of money. Because when you're living in chronic stress at home or work, the last thing that feels accessible is a spa day or a meditation retreat.
We have personally struggled with all of these things, and that's why we created the Body Deck. This affirmation card deck has 77 intentionally designed beautiful cards to help you address all three of these high vibe killers in just a couple minutes a day. These affirmations will help you tune into your body and your inner world, practice positive self-talk, and best of all, it's super portable and affordable. For only $33, benefit from the transformative practice of affirmations anywhere you go.
So if you're ready to stop the self-sabotage and start being the highest version of yourself, you'll definitely want to get your hands on the Body Deck Affirmation Cards. Head over to soulea.co. That's soulea.co to get the Body Deck Affirmation Cards today. You can also find the link in the show notes.